But if you have minority opinions, what do you do? Or if you have your own opinions, what do you do? In other words, is Nixon really your candidate of the year? Does he represent everything you want? Or is this important? Is it important that he even know that you have other opinions or you disagree with him? Or do you think we should just let it go right there and say, well, we're living comfortably and Nixon won't disturb us too much, this or that? Yes, you can win with your issues. But the individual with his own opinions has very little influence, except with a small group of people who might read his books or might listen to him talk. And possibly this is a good thing. Maybe it is. I don't know, but maybe it isn't.
Or has it ever been different?
Well, how about times of Jefferson and Adams and Monroe and Washington? Did they represent their people, or were they individual freethinkers who stood up?
Well, I think that they had a concept of government that doesn't exist anymore.
Why not? Isn't that what you base your democracy on, what they proclaim, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution?
Well, we're living today under a system, as the gentleman said, everybody is wanting an interest in what he can get for himself, which has come to be through the socialistic nature of our government. When our government doesn't give anything to anybody anymore, but only enforces the law, people are going to change their minds.
How is that? You mean, if there's no welfare, aid to education, and so forth, then we might get indignant about government?
Well, not only do we get indignant, but those who, for instance, if we didn't have this socialistic approach that we have, both in government and people, education would be taken care of by the groups. Like our fathers did before us.
You still get back to the same problem of what do you do about the people who can't take care of themselves?
You always have had the problem, you never can get away from it.
They say the poor are always with us, but and does that mean they simply shove them aside, put them back in the corner?
No. You have to do with and for them what you can, but you can't solve the problem.
It seemed to me, and I thought it for a long time, that the place that we missed the boat, and most of you are too young to even remember it, was in the 30s during the Depression, as Christian people, we allow the government to take over the things that we as Christian people should have been doing. At that time, we had our great Christian opportunity to share and do for people that were down and out. It was a terrible situation. And instead of that, we let the government take over what was our Christian duty.
But how could someone, for instance, in the Lutherans, for instance, who are much more, perhaps three main groups today, how could our fragmented groups have attacked the problem as effectively as...
Our own churches on our own level could have done a lot.
I agree, but perhaps the government did fill a void which was necessary to be filled.
We didn't even try. Now the Quakers tried and the Mormons tried, and they never accepted one single thing from the government. And they not only took care of their own people, but they took care of many other people of no denomination and no faith. And we didn't lift our hands. And we're reaping what we sowed.
Can we get back to that point?
Yes, you can.
Really?
Yes, you can, if you're willing to share your own.
Not only that, we're going to. If our country goes on, well, you already carry it in your pocket. Your money is worthless right now, which is a betrayal. Let me cite you a case. I knew of a woman who lost her husband when he was 59 years old. He left her in 1939. He left her $17,000. she believed and he believed that she had all she needed for the rest of her life. The woman today is penniless. She thought she didn't need a house at that time and didn't buy one. She could have at that time bought a house and still had $15,000 in the bank. Today she's penniless, she has no home. Now when a government does this to a citizen, what's happened?
But what other alternatives besides putting your money in the bank did this woman have? For instance, her Christian friends could have perhaps advised her on more better ways of investing her money and so on to protect her against it. I wouldn't say this is the government's fault of betraying the woman. I think it's very unfortunate it happened, and I'm very sad to hear it, but perhaps there were other things that could have been undone at that time to avert that.
Isn't this one of the foundation stones of our government?
What?
To protect the property of people? And money is property. Someone comes and burns your house down and the government says, too bad. How do you feel? I mean, do you have a government, really?
I think if a government is protecting you like that, they're stepping beyond their boundary.
Mm. The government didn't take her money. She spent the money as she wished. It was a progress. You can't halt progress. And the cost of living keeps going up. Granted, so now you leave your wife $40,000 and maybe 50 years from now, she won't have a nickel or a home either. But that's progress. I mean, you can't
progress. Is that progress?
No. But Greg, if you tell your wife in your will to invest this in the stock market, perhaps this won't happen.
Fine, but that was her. It wasn't the government that didn't betray her, because I'm so unreasonable. You could call the government betraying the woman because now she doesn't have any money.
Well, the point is that if the government had protected the value of money, she wouldn't have had to use it as she had to use it.
Well, actually, you're asking for more governmental control than we had.
Yeah.
He's asking for the government to do what it perhaps should have done in the first place and didn't do.
And that's right.
It has the power to, or it ought to have the power to stabilize the value of the dollar. And in failing to do so, it abrogated one of its responsibilities. So you're not asking it to do more than it should, but simply do what it should.
I don't know. She would say, along Kurt's idea, that this woman could have consulted a competent broker or a competent legal advisor or so forth as to how to best employ her funds. Or even on the question, should she buy a house or not? Was the property good? Would it be raised for a superhighway in the next 10 years? These things, she says, in our private enterprise economy, we are able to know. And the private enterprise people, the people who are out for business, should be the only ones who control this, and not the government. Because the government shouldn't be obliged to control people's funds or even give advice on that, because the government has no way of knowing.
Well, this is right, what you say, but the fluctuation of the value of the dollar is purely a governmental matter.
You mean the government could control it, but they're not,
well,
they're not stimulating it.
Well, of course they are. Every time the government throws money into the economy, it's making you, the money you have, worth less.
Actually, in a sense, the government can control something like prices, because they can put a, what you call a ceiling on prices, and you can't sell an item or a product higher than a certain amount, and that keeps control over the price. But there's still a little inflation.
There is a bit of price control, like the collusion between GE and Westinghouse. There are many antitrust suits pending now between such corporations as GM, which we don't know the outcome. And there is kind of a control of the maximum amount of damage done. or maybe, as I say, it is damaged already.
Sometimes a product can be franchised too, and a certain thing you can't sell below a certain price, you can't sell above a certain price, but it's probably the same thing.
You notice that you're traveling on airplanes and otherwise is very regulated, the sheriff regulation, opposed to minimum fee that they can charge and a maximum for airways. And there isn't much ability to compete with lower prices these days in the transportation market because it's very much stabilized. If you are a shipper, a trucking firm, you cannot induce more business or cannot bring more business by saying, well, for the next month, we're going to lower our rates in half or by a little bit, maybe just to undersell our Joe Blow over here, you know, so we can get more business. That kind of enterprise is out nowadays because we have regulated the rates considerably. We not only give maximums, but we give minimums as well.
And they control it better?
Yeah.
Well, the same aspect of the form of produce, too. To regulate the laws applied to that, of course, to stabilize the prices of other forms of produce without allowing any plant as much as you want to do the plant. If you flood the market, say wheat, that's what lower the price of wheat. We have to stabilize it. Someone has to do it. So the ups and downs.
Is that good or not?
It's hard to say.
Can you rely more on the economy? If someone wants to undersell you, then you try to you have to undersell them, like the gas war thing that goes on. Can we go back to the system or not? Sure, this will wipe out some farmers, but then again, the price of wheat will go down quite, it'll reach its rock bottom price if people compete on price methods alone.
They do compensate them by paying in a certain amount for not playing. This, I didn't believe it was right.
Yeah.
Paying someone not to do something.
What is fair about this? I talked to a owner of a supermarket, and he said the reason the price of certain cereals had gone up and would go up drastically in 6 months before the spring was because the United States had sent all their surplus wheat overseas in rain, and this caused a price jump.
Well, according
to the consumer stuff is here, and I don't know what the farmer does.
You've got another problem, though, as food becomes more highly processed, the farmer gets less of the money. A box of cornflakes, a farmer perhaps gets 2 cents of that. A loaf of bread, how many cents of wheat goes into a loaf of bread? It's ridiculously low.
And yet the price would be about 35 or 40 cents now.
Let me say something. When there isn't any competition, though, prices are usually higher, and, well, this is a little off, but let's say that they always tell me it takes a lot of money to ship products up on the boat here, and the price of the fare on the boat is high because they are the only boat company that's operating around the Lake Shore. There's no competition.
Subject and back to that original point, but I was just kind of interested in what you people should we
stay. Let's go back to the original point, okay?
Yeah, this is getting kind of like. I was just wondering though if anybody does feel that. Well, it's quite obvious that we are regulated by everything in the United States, the economic system, the political system, and everything else. Is there a way that we can get back to a point of individuality and self-importance or something? Didn't you say that you thought there was?
I think there is, if you're willing to. If you're willing, if you want it.
Well, how can you get everyone to want it
you
at the
can.
Same time? This is a thing.
But then you're regulating again.
Yeah.
But I don't think you will ever do anything you don't want to do. I don't think anybody does.
Let me give you an example of how it was for me. I operated a computer in Chicago for Ward's, And I did not do for 10 hours of my life, for months, what I wanted to do. I had to get up at a certain time when my job started. I had to spend an hour on a subway going to work. This I didn't like. It was noisy, for one thing. And it was the only way to get into town. And then I had to operate
a computer.
That's why
you did it. So you chose to do it.
I chose to do it initially under the thinking that all of this existence of the noise and our getting there and so forth wouldn't be bad. I could overlook this.
For the conversation.
That's right. So you chose to do this.
And yeah, the point is that we do have this choice, but you don't necessarily always choose what you want to do. You may choose the most expedient thing.
That's it.
But not necessarily your, you know, what's going to make you the happiest.
Well, this may be true. But you always do what you want. You give up your happiness for what you do.
Well, yeah. All you're saying then is that we do have a freedom of choice.
I think.
Yeah.
Well, and that we don't have to blame anybody else for what happens.
Are we? How about the hidden persuaders? You're going to mention Madison Avenue.
Yeah, this is creating false wants or things we don't need to boost the economy to sell more cigarettes, more cars, more
cornflakes
and everything else to push it, but they're selling it, and if people hadn't thought of it, they're going to make sure they think of it through the mediums of television, etc. So if they can use that kind of power to make people want something, then there must be another way to make people want to do something, not just the biological consumption.
This seems a little unreal in the face of the fact that the significant fact of our time is that population is increasing about twice as fast as food production, and that 15,000 people per day are losing the choice between living and starving to death. Not even having the choice of between doing what you want and what would contribute to your happiness is light years out of the question. It's a choice between staying alive and starving to death, which 15,000 people per day are losing. Now, somehow we've gotten into this mess, and the experts and those who are concerned are racking their brains. What can we possibly do to keep our whole world from dying before the end of this century? And they've all come to the conclusion that private work and private enterprise have absolutely failed, and that it is absolutely dependent on the governments of the have nations. If we leave things even as they are, with limited foreign aid, we can't really expect to see the next century. It's going to take massive cooperation by everyone. And this is all great if you can posit the unfallen man who, when he knows the right thing, will do it. But that man is so rare that I can only think of one in the human race. And without a massive regeneration of all humanity, which doesn't seem likely, I think we're going to have to, much as we don't like it, put all our collective powers together and each of us give up a little bit so that the race can survive.
What, you mean we're going to start that?
The world is starving to death.
I don't think we will.
Oh, sorry.
That's the technology for growing food. I think it's impossible.
There is a fallacy in this thing of the world starving to death. And the fallacy is that this has been going on all the time. But there is an increase in
it because
the human race is multiplying.
The ratio between population development and food production is rapidly, widening.
This is true.
I mean, there's always been people starving and there's always been food being produced, but there's becoming much more people, the gap.
The gap is increasing.
But they can
be. And the reason for this, of course, is that where the population increase is the highest, that's where the agricultural progress is the poorest.
But Kaiser Lumen Music is in here, and all the experts say that in 1963, we passed the point where the traditional cultivation of every arable acre of land in the world would not be
feed the human race. And something drastic has to be done. And individuals just are not going to come up with the know-how or the willpower to do anything about it.
The Ford Foundation puts out the information that in areas where it has been working, it has increased the production of rice, for example, 15 times within 12 years. Now, how widespread this is, I don't know.
Dave Brown says that the people who are seeing an answer think that if we wait maybe 5 years until the famine conditions are at hand, that we'll just have to make tough choices, like maybe writing off the subcontinent of India. We'll just have to decide which parts of the world we can possibly save.
Let me ask, is it really, are we obliged to save other nations that are starving?
We could say that in the last century, but in this century, when communication and transportation could bring this revolution and descent to our own shores, I wonder if that kind of isolationism is realistic.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I see it, I was thinking on your line only more in terms of just the United States. It seems like, well, 100 years ago, people had more choice than we do now. I mean, definitely. The corporations and the government stuff didn't have that much control. It just seems like everything kind of snowballs, and the whole, I suppose, human race is just kind of in the same predicament. I mean, that we really don't have any choice anymore. We're like the United States. There's absolutely no way where we can get back to what, you know, to where the individual matters or anything like that. And that it'll probably self-destruct the United States anymore.
Maybe that's what that book was about. You say we have no choice except to have the government take over. And that is an example of what a beautiful choice this is. And that finally, in the end, we discovered the value of the individual as being the most important thing in the world.
Yeah, but I mean, I believe that the individual is important, but as an individual, you can't change anything, it's very difficult to change anything anyone else believes. And like, only when he discovered the individual is important, I mean, only then. I mean, only when the system kind of extinguished or destructed. I mean, putting that system destruct and then realize the importance of the individual again.
It condemned that,
we
did it.
Or how did it end?
Well, that society, we soon continue.
Yes.
He doesn't narrate a lot because he's gone from there. But it appears that it continued. But you notice that they had to give up a lot of things to develop this brotherhood. Men could not associate with women because this would cause individual love and partnership, and this would break away from the unity of mankind. Men of one trade could not talk to men of another trade, except for three or more were gathered together in social meetings, because this might cause preference. Preference was a sin. Thinking to yourself alone, or writing about yourself or to yourself, or writing about what you like to write is a preference and a transgression. It's a sin. A lot of freedoms they gave up. The freedom of privacy. They had to sleep in dorms of 100. That's why they reject dying land. But is it also possible that we are getting kind of this way?
Yeah.
Are we invading our privacy a little bit more each day? The government. What will next 1970 census be? How many questions will they ask? How about when the FBI proposes to keep a computerized record of every individual born in the United States, what he did, his age, his status, and so forth? We now have in our criminal files of the FBI 120 million Americans are on file and can be checked upon any minute now by their fingerprints. And most of these, the bulk of them, 70 million, are government workers. And all government workers have to be on file in this fingerprint system.
So eventually all of us will be on file.
Sure.
If you get a moving violation, you might be on file.
We're working toward that.
And don't you think that it won't be long before they take their, all your money and give back enough?
I do.
In the banks, suppose that they decide to take away all the money and just leave you with a small amount. For combined efforts or a new industry that they want to develop for the betterment of mankind. Is that possible? Well, this idea of privacy, I kind of think the telephone, by the way, is an invasion of my privacy most of the time. But I can see the development already of the criminal records that we keep, and maybe the census next time we'll have more intimate questions about ourselves, and they will remember them.
Given that as individuals, though, like you were mentioning, like here, while ago, where's going to start there? Given back that point, as far as individuals go, could we as individuals supply the world population a certain amount of food? I don't think it's possible. I think it would take a tremendous amount of energy and money, and which would not make the government have large corporations who can develop arid land and develop fertilizers and new growth processes to speed up the growth process for food. We as individuals, I couldn't do this. It takes money to develop arid lands, to irrigate them, to provide this technology to move food faster
and find it
in larger quantities. So what do you do?
Yeah.
Well, in other words, are we supposed to make a decision at this point whether or not we're going to take and Ironman's, you know, original community and, you know, the center on a basis and feed the world, you know, for the good of mankind?
I think we actually want to do two things. We want
yeah.
to vote.
Or are we going to the other extreme and just say, look, we can't do it, I'm most important, you know? I mean, is there a decision that has to be made somewhere along the way? Or, and even, you know, is that, where does the decision start? You know?
I
want to
ask a question with that. You said, perhaps, places like India will become expendable. Brought to mind a curious point the woman made in a discussion once, saying that God promised to take care of his people. And since the people in India generally weren't Christian, that this is the way it went. They weren't industrious enough to work and help themselves.
Possibly Hitler said something like that too
about
that. I'm not saying that she was Hitler, but.
Well, I've often thought of it,
but wondered. And it comes much closer. It comes much closer than that. Who lived here before your great grandfather came? What happened to all those people?
We segregated them. Yeah, we segregated them into a type of segregation on reservations, which is
well,
even
first
worse.
We killed off about 3-4 of them. Then we ended up with the rest.
Well, don't you think that if enough malnutrition and starvation set in 15 years or whatever the deadline is, that disease will take over and we'll have mass epidemics?
That's a hope. You know, it's funny how they say, hopefully there will be another black plague to rid most of our population of this world. This is a factor, but we have medical developments. We have penicillin. We have these modern pills with bacteria. And this we have knocked out almost every disease except cancer and heart disease and a few other minor diseases that could affect us. So actually, plagues like leprosy and that infections or even a black plague, maybe we could knock this out technically as soon as it started. A doctor, Pauling, proposed that the influenza of 1960 was kind of that crowding crisis. It happened in cities, and he thought that maybe it was a biological way of extinguishing the race. He said it wasn't deliberately that way, but he says when you get crowded so much in a city, your resistance lowers. From fatigue and the noise and so forth, and that influenza was possible to go like that.
Well, in Canada, there is a creature called a marmot, a small rose-like thing that every 7 years can become overpopulated. They all head to the Pacific, and they go over all obstacles in land to reach the sea, plunge into the sea, and swim westward until they're all drowned.
Oh.
The phenomena I saw film on.
I think it's lemming or the
sea wolf. The lemming. Something by the lemming.
taking a little of the population.
Is there some theory that, I don't know anything about, but I've heard that, at least in a situation of a state, like the Roman Empire or something, like 200 years in margin, self-described itself, and other empires will approximately 200 to 300 years, and then completely self-destruct and start all over again. And somebody's saying that the United States now is about 200 years, and it's going to...
200 years no
world. Right, and it's just going to completely fall apart and start over. It's had to be
200 years. Hmm? It has been by 200 years.
Oh, it hasn't been?
It has been.
It has been.
It's better.
Uh-huh.
How do you mean by fall apart?
Well, just what I think, I see it. Well, everything. I see it. That is in place now.
Yeah, do you
think
complete chaos.
Do you think the real reason the dress will decay our society?
Well, just a combination of a lot of things. I mean, I think we're there now. I mean, I don't think any of us have any choice. I mean, just as far as the Negro situation goes, I mean, you get a group together of young people and you say, well, we're going to go out and make everybody, you know, I mean, we're going to demonstrate and do everything, and we're going to get everybody in this country to love Negroes, you know. And, I mean, it's just hopeless. You get a group like this together, and you try and develop objectives, you know, because you have to work from some ground, and you can't think of any objectives. I mean, I don't know, 100 years ago, maybe an individual could have done something. But now, even a very dynamic individual, except someone like Hitler or something like that, you can't, I mean, I feel that I have no will, even with a vote, I have no choice what will happen to this country. I mean, I can't help in any way.
But isn't it the individuals that make people know?
Yes, but
yes, everything does make a difference. A person expresses their opinion. Maybe other people will call them.
Yeah, it's the status quo. And now when you're trying to reform and change people's ideas, that they're going to drive us around.
Yeah, but people can do this, though.
Okay, but...
Someone wrote that the course of history has always been changed by a small nucleus of people with a will.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Individuals,
you
band together, and start a movement.
Yeah, but like in the case of the Roman Empire, it was in so deep, you know, in destruction, self-destruction, why didn't a new group come up and completely reform everything and start over? I mean, why did it destruct first and then it started?
They did.
What?
They did.
But was it one evolutionary process?
Well, this happened right here. Ayn Rand said, the Great Reversion, this character said that there were a few evil ones who knew a lot. They spoke a lot, they wrote a lot. And the great majority of us, we fought for the sakes of mankind against them, and we burned them, we burned their books, we burned their words. For 3 months, the script fires went on, and they were totally wiped out. And then from that point on, we can good for the betterment of mankind. Mm-hmm. So that last we achieved our utopia. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. But if you've read George Orwell's 1984, it's along the same lines.
Aren't we becoming more and more like this character in the end? You ever watched the mass exodus from the cities on Friday night? Everyone in the world is heading out to get away from everything that we've built so long, so many years we've worked to build. And yet on Friday night, the mass of people that converges on the countryside, and everybody buys a little square parcel. I'm guilty too, because I have two of them. Yeah, they all come back on Sunday, but they can't wait for Friday again to come around. So they can get out and get away from it.
They really don't have any choice in the society.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm kind of bad in that way because I just don't.
Where I live in the summertime, there are people who work just as little as they can. They work during the summer, and and during the winter they don't. Then it's settled for less money.
Why are we all here?
What?
Why are we here?
Are we all here?
Yeah.
I'd like to cite the word for what they call in the 1960s to recognize.
Yeah. It's invisible. I don't mind. I'd go away. Put it away. I want to.
The migration in the city, or out of the city, the exodus. People were getting disgusted living in the city because the slums were moving in. The slums were taking up the old homes and the old German and Polish neighborhoods. So naturally, the white suburbia developed. They moved to the suburbs to get away. And now there's a trend to go back into the high-rises in the center of the city, which are costly but pretty well protected. Isn't this kind of going that way as well? I know in some cities, like New York, the idea was to get away from the old neighborhood, the old moisture, whatever they call it, and get into a home of their own. Something more costly, to go to a doctor somewhere in the suburbia. And what happened when they vacated these old houses, naturally it's easier for someone with less money to buy it. Maybe a slum develops this way. Do we have a responsibility that when we leave our homes like that, and we leave the city as a home neighborhood, are we responsible for the next slum or the next neighborhood that develops in the area? When we leave these old houses in the city, slums come up. Now, of course, we can say, well, to hell with it, we sold it, it's not ours anymore. And then eventually the city taxes get us. We have to pay for tenements inside a city. We have to pay for slum removal and things like that. How do you sell something like this? Do you just say we won't move or do you move anything? I would suggest that there was a lot of ignorance along this, and certainly supported tenements in there.
Well, how are they going to control that when they can't even control, persuade people to, even if you persuade the homeowners to sell their house or stand for their right to sell to other than white?
With himself. And it's only as man is a Christian that he is able to do something against it. Even then he's still in conflict, because you and I are in conflict, otherwise we'd never be tempted. And yet we are tempted, so we live in conflict too. Now, government cannot stop this. The only thing that government can do here is where the great tragedy has happened in our land. Our land, our government at first was dedicated to what the New Testament speaks of in government, and to bear the sword and punish the evildoer and praise those who do well. The government's got its hand in everything under the sun, trying to control things. And suppose someone would come and move into your house and want to control you. Would that make you a better person or a worse person? I think I hate the guy, first thing. You throw him out, yes. If you see, do you have the authority, this would be the next. You see what I mean?
Well, it's our Christian duty to see that people have their housing so that they don't revolt.
Well, that's not a Christian then. It's so they don't revolt, so they won't hurt you.
Well, I just share what we have. I went to a meeting last week with the Black Militant Leader. He had a college degree, by the way. And he was trying to help people in the community get what was right for them. And he said, someone asked him once, well, what is it you want? He said, just make an inventory. He says, I want everything that you have. And he says, if we don't. He says, if I don't get it, okay, you're not going to have it either. And he was a militant. I don't know how many of those people feel this way, but they had it. But here they can't wait any longer.
But I suppose you felt this way. There are people who have things that you don't have. That's it. You go to them and say, if you don't give me what you have, then take it from me.
Well, what happened? Isn't that what happened in the revolution in France? When people revolted
and something didn't have enough to eat? If you've seen The Good Earth, something similar happens. There's a famine. All the farmers move in from the land because it's dry as hell and they can't get anything off of it. They go to the cities, and then the city gets so jammed that somehow some revolutionaries come up and say, tomorrow we will have everything. Everyone will have food on their plate, chicken in a pot kind of thing. And then somehow the armies roll through and there's chaos. And in this, I guess they break the temples down, they steal the jewels, and they upset the old order of things. At least economically, they get rid of much of the wealth inside the temple or inside the king or whatever it may have been that was controlling at that time. Doesn't this always happen to some extent, I would say?
Well, I heard Pearl Buck speak last October at a lecture on man's creativity, and someone asked her some questions about the background of this story, and she said that the revolutionaries, young people who wanted something better, wanted a change, but when they destroyed the old order, the structure of the government, they replaced it with nothing better, and this left a vacuum, and that's what created the problem afterwards.
And isn't this history?
Because they didn't have the education or the trained personnel to come in and fill that vacuum.
If you know the history of Russia or the history of Red China? Did they go forward or did they go backward? Are the people better off or worse off? If we could know, for instance, how many Chinese people have been killed in the last 15 years, we wouldn't talk about people starving to death. Because it'd be such a small group, it wouldn't matter. But you don't hear this. The same thing with Russia. When Finland was invaded and Estonia and so on, the Lutheran Church lost 4 million Lutherans in 5 years. Nobody knows where they are. They disappeared.
There's a lot lost. Another surprising, well, on this line, people generally say, people modern, they say, well, you want something new. Or you don't like the old system, why don't you suggest something new? And Luther himself, in his table talk, I just read the other night, said that they were attacking him because he was eliminating all these formalities inside the church, a lot of rituals. And Luther, well, if you take all this out, what are you going to put in there? You've got to suggest something to replace it. And he said, ridiculous. And he said, why don't you guys suggest another ritual substituting for the old ritual? And I don't know. Of course, you need another government substituting for the old one, I suppose. But I wouldn't necessarily have a blanket statement either about revolutions as a whole. In America, we kind of want to maintain a democracy where people can suggest new ways of doing things, new techniques or new ideas, new systems. And this is the democratic tradition of English speaking. And of course, I'm sure many of us kind of think in this way, if you think of America originating along these principles. But as my contention is that the individual has very little power by himself, unless he's a great artist or he happens to be very popular on the radio or TV or something, to really influence his government in his day. He may be able to talk like this talk right here to you few people, and maybe you'll tell your friends and so forth. This might geometrically expand, and maybe in 100 years, this might be the new trend if I suggest a new idea to you. But I would never see this. I would be dead by that time, and I would have gone through a system which I didn't like. So. And have we approached that point where the individual means nothing? Dean told me that, he says, the most you can do is influence a small circle of friends and hope they'll carry the message around. He said, we really have no other power, except that before elections we can suggest ideas. But he says that the elections kind of represent after the ideas, and they put the ideas to the test.
Mm-hmm. See alternatives. And, I keep thinking of the fact that Upton Sinclair, who is still alive as a young man, had to write against the time of free enterprise, in which when you blow a can of lard, you couldn't be sure that the bones of some workmen weren't in that can, because the perfectly free meatpacking company was not compelled to put a railing around its lard rendering vat that saved a few pounds by not putting it, and then all in. There was no regulation, and the fact that Helen Keller's just died, and if you see the movie about her life, her teacher said that there was one house in town for the syphilitic prostitutes, for the deaf, for the lame, for the elderly, for the mentally ill, for the mentally retarded. Everyone who was society's junk was stuck in the test house. This is free enterprise. This is individual initiative. This, and I just wonder if... It takes a little bit of surrendering our liberty to the government. After all, the government's us, isn't it? I mean, who is it if it isn't us? Isn't it worth it? Would it really be that much better for the individual to know that once he isn't one of Ayn Rand's beautiful people, the strong, the proud, the able to achieve, that he'd be stuck in a hole of that way? Is that really worth it? And this is within our generation. I just wonder if it isn't more positive for me to surrender a few of my liberties to know that once I am not an active contributor, that I won't be jumped. I'd rather surrender a few now and know that I have a little something to look forward to.
Well, as I say, one of your premises isn't the government after all of us, is it? My contention is that it is a very small aim, that I occupy 10 cubic feet or something, but that's about it for me. That's how I feel about it.
I'm just looking at this. It seems to me that the end of the 19th century was the very best conditions for the flowering of the individual-oriented society. There was the wealth, there was the power, there was the Horatio Alger philosophy of the self-made man that should have produced the very best conditions. And yet, in terms of respect to the individual, it produced the pest house where everyone was left to rot. And I just think that no matter how much Ms. Ron thinks that turning it back to the individual and solve the problem, I think we tried. And I think that we found that it was weighing the balance and found wanting.
But I don't believe that that's true world over in every community, that an individual could then test out. think they are shining examples of just the very opposite.
Where it was
true that they were pleasant rest houses, but rest of us, eh?
Taken away from the village. They know what. They accept it. It isn't that they go out somewhere and everybody packs up and runs away while they're gone. They know that they're taken away and they know why they're going out there and they sit and wait. They know that they're out there to die because so that little George down there, the little one, will have a little more food. Because there are Eskimos starving ridiculous amounts in Alaska. You see a lot more of it when you live there.
They're nomads and they can't carry any meals,
right.
Body.
And they always know this. They know when they get to a certain point, I'm no longer functional. My teeth are worn off to the gums from chewing hide and I'm no good anymore. And they know that this is, you know, this is their life. This is the way they've lived for centuries. And this is the type of people that they are. They're very strong-willed people. I couldn't do it.
They're also some of the
They are. They're some of the happiest people you could imagine, and under some of the poorest and rotten conditions you could imagine, too. I've never seen anything in, well, in the lower 48 that, as far as slums, that can equal some of the things that those people live in up there. It's ridiculous. Just in a hole in the ground with a bunch of moss over the top of it. And that's where they live, and that's where they bear their young. And it's ridiculous. It really is.
Why is it ridiculous, though? They're happy.
Are they? Would you be happy if you were up the street?
Not when...
I think they are. Like, really, you come to the end of your rope, they're fatalists. They're not productive anymore.
No, this is what I mean. They realize that they are no longer productive. When Billy doesn't have any more teeth.
I think if you can face death, with no fear and realizing the reality of death, I think you're a very strong person, and this is, I think, what we see in the Eskimos.
Yeah.
Medicine is really a paradoxical thing, It's done, of course, fantastic things to prevent pain and But it's also, it's prolonged death, like you were saying, keeping you alive with Venus, too.
As an example, I do Ernest Hemingway. And this is a fantastic man, in my mind anyway, just fantastic. He led a full life, he was a wonderful author, and when he became, he realized that he was no longer productive. I mean, he was gradually becoming psychotic. And he knew this, and he could no longer write, and he just didn't want to continue without being able to hunt and fish and knock off a book every year that was a good quality book. He said, well, there's no way, and he just blew his brains out. And I admire this. I've been criticized by English professors, for admiring this type of man.
But now, if you say you admire this man, then you throw God into the junkie.
No, you do not.
Well, God has given life. Who has the right to take it?
Would you admire a 27-year-old man who did the same thing for nearly the same reason?
Yes, if a 27-year-old man could not be productive, there was absolutely no way that he was a benefit to himself, his family, or society, as was the case of Hemingway. I would admire an individual of any age that made a decision.
So then there is no God who is Lord.
I believe that everything in our life is predetermined. I believe that we cannot challenge our fate. I mean, some people feel that they change their fate. Like Oedipus. Are you familiar with the Oedipus complex story? Where he thought he would, go away and change his fate, when in reality the gods had it all predetermined. And I'm a believer in this, and this is Calvinism. This is not un-Christian.
I protest! You see, just as soon as I can judge all matters and make all decisions.
I'm not saying that.
Well,
I'm saying exactly the opposite of that.
How do you know your fate?
Pardon me?
How do you know your fate?
You cannot, just by accepting what happens. What is this prayer? Give me the power to accept those things that I cannot change. The power to use those things that I have been given, something like this.
It wasn't no different.
Right.
Maybe at 28, the thing would have broken through that would have saved the guy who pulled the
trigger. Yeah, whether it would or wouldn't. If God is Lord, then I cannot tamper with my life.
Well, it's a gift. You cannot sit down and just, you cannot go to your room and just sit down and wait for things to happen. In this manner, you can tamper with your wife. You must go out and live life. You cannot sit and wait for God to send fireballs from heaven or a neon message in a cloud.
Well, and just Job go out and drown himself.
Pardon me?
Yeah, Job. If anybody ever wanted out, he should have.
Cursed God and died was the suggestion of Job.
I think God is, God is Lord, yes. But he gives you the faculties of thinking and stuff. And in a sense, I was reading through this one book and I came upon one statement that said, God, I think God chose me to be an atheist. And it was funny at first, paradoxical. But in a sense, I think God does choose people to be atheists in that he's given them their faculties of thought. And sometimes, just because of these faculties, they can't accept some things. And the same with the suicide. I mean, God has given you a brain, and so you think of it, and you know, sometimes you just don't have any free will on that.
Well, suicide is the fourth biggest killer in our nation, and I'm wondering where you draw the line between somebody doing it quickly with a gun and all the people who wish to say, well, I'm no good, I'm going to, and they drink themselves to death or use drugs and go the same route.
Well, I have no respect for an individual that just prolongs his misery and the misery of the people around him by his own personal neglect. But in the case of Ernest Hemingway, I think this was an admirable thing for him to do. I think he was just imagine the magnitude of sitting down and cooling, making this decision, calculating all the odds, all the different angles, and making the decision that, well, at one point I was a magnificent person. I had thousands of admirers. I had ability unlimited. I was enjoying life every day. I could wake up, you know, have a wonderful period, every morning about period. And then suddenly, boom, no longer could he experience any of these things. In his estimation, and in the estimation of many people close to him, he was well along the road to being just nothing.
If this is just, if this is acceptable, then we can solve all our problems. It's just set up a judge or a jury somewhere, and they'll decide who ought to live and who should.
This is an entirely personal decision. This is not to be regulated by the state, the community. This must be regulated from within your spirit, your soul.
I think he had
a belief in a supernatural being. Now, just how much this regulated his life, I don't know. He led a life that many devout Christians, in the Victorian sense of the word Christian, would say was, you know, a life of sin and wrongdoing. I mean, you know, he made it with the women, and he was a heavy drinker, and he had good times. He owned a boat, a yacht. You know, his wife was very idealistic. You know, I mean, hunting and fishing and going to bullfights and having wonderful experiences with different people and writing, and this was it.
The difference between Oedipus and Hemingway, what I see as a Christian, is not so much the lordship of God as the redemption of Christ. The fact that Christ, at the absolute bottom of what human existence should be, you know, he was not only successful, he was convinced that what he was doing was of the utmost significance. And as far as we know, God didn't say, just go through this, and I'll feed you, and you'll fight right back up again. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Everything was gone. But in the very next breath, even though you've forsaken me, even though I don't know you're there, even though I have no idea what's going to happen, in your hands, it's your decision. And it seems to me that says that life is worth it. And God has said yes to life, whether the temporal things you build up are gone or not.
John Cooper would argue to them, yeah.
I'd argue back.
I did too. He tried to present the position that Jesus, in the hour of, you know, his blackest hour, made an all-out attempt to save himself. And I disagree with
him. That's killing, because I'm going on to debate myself. At the point of absolute despair, he still trusted, even though there was absolutely no evidence that he should trust.
Is it despair, or is Hemingway saying, all right, I've tried everything that you have to offer for life, and I find it not worth it, I find it not existing, not getting up one day for it. And so why should I keep on going through this hang-up of trying new things or just eating the same old bland foods and living the same way?
Yeah, he went to root, you know, I mean, it's not like the sparrow, like you say, oh, God, you know, something like that. It's no.
No, he gave you know, accepted human means of coping with this problem with rape. I mean, he went to Rochester Male Psychiatric Clinic, and he went to all the specialists, and he went on the diets, you know, no alcohol, you know, oatmeal, and all this junk. And I can understand his position. You know, what is the purpose of life if you cannot enjoy the things that mean a lot to you?
Well, but he had a choice. He contributed to his own dissertation.
No, he did not. I mean, it's a question of values. I mean, are you going to live a life denying yourself the things that give you great pleasure just so you can live to be 110? I'm perfectly happy. I will be, I'm sure. People tell me I won't be, but I will be perfectly happy to go out at 55 if I can live a full life, a life that's meaningful to me and the people around me. I have no desire to live to be 85, 90, if I can't live the way in which I would want to. I have seen people, I know people that do, that have a good time at 80 years old. They can enjoy a football game without, you know, asking, well, what the hell is going on?
So, doing how meaningful life,
or is Hemingway could do no more good?
What is your value system? Human life is worth by the long have A, productive, B, receiving pleasure, this and this. Well, some people say that hinges from there is a satisfaction to life without physical gratification.
Okay, and just breathing.
Well, the thing seems to be as little physical gratification on the meditation deck. We should get beyond all that.
Well, that's fine. You know, I mean, I can't see it for myself. No.
Well, he didn't have the faith to stick around and see if there was something more for him after the strenuous life of COVID.
Well, Hemingway had lived as an ascetic for a year. He had attempted this. He thought, maybe if I got rid of all this bullshit, he just lived basically with just ordinary food and without even books and stuff.
Right.
He tried that, and it didn't work.
He classified his doctor's orders and the way his doctors commanded him to live as escapism, I think, from what, you know, he sought and he desired. And an individual that realizes that he is corrupting himself by living an unnatural life for him, I think, is justified. I thought it was a pretty strong thing to do.
Well, could he, my question is, could he have the reason Christ? I mean, because it seems like everybody in sometime in their life, well, first of all, everybody has some feeling of some supernatural being, you know, God or something, through the arts or through anything. And that's fine as long as it's giving you pleasure. But everyone then finally reaches a point where they say, well, you know, nothing's going right, I might as well kill myself. Well, that's the point where it seems like Christ and the redemption of Christ would be the only answer.
I think as I understand it, he was a very independent individual. You know, the rock, the fortress, his own personality. This was his makeup. But I think that he did believe in Christ. He wasn't, I don't think, an overly religious man. I know authority. I did some research on it, but his love of nature, his love of the natural goodness of the world, you know, the wildlife and God's creation. I think that he realized.
Yeah, I think everybody has that
thought,
but I think this is
like
the only place where Christ comes in.
Well, I don't think he completely denied the existence of Christ. I don't know. I've never read either one way or another, but this was just the personal hypothesis on him.
Well, part of he wrote a poem which is very much criticizing in Paris when he was writing poetry for a while. It had something to the effect of that not only cats masturbate, but monks also do it in themselves. And he said, in all this woe, what am I to do? That was his attitude. He said that, I think his attitude would be along the lines, he would say, well, Christ was a good guy, but, you know, look at how most of humanity is taking him. It's really not good.
And what can I do about it myself as a person, not a thing?
Thank you, Dean.
He saw so many bad things about, let's say, the church or this or that religious person, or even the blindness of some zealots and so forth, that, you know, as a human person, he couldn't tolerate this, and he wondered what he could do about it.
But I don't think he was, I think he was an optimistic individual, basically. And I think he would seek out the goodness of an individual when this person came to him. I mean, he was an escapist. I mean, an individual in a personal spotlight like he was, he had to be very careful. I mean, but, you know, there's instances when people would come to him, you know, an engagement conversation, and he would take them, he would accept them for what they were and what they could offer as being a part of his whole life, as being a part of his whole personal experience. So I don't think that he went around looking for things to knock in people.
Question. Did I understand you say that you did a bit of coming away research?
Yeah.
Do you have any rights in specific instances you're now, or the thing you're now looking to? For people in relationships, to other people, in health relationships?
Yeah, there were times,
Gertrude Stein would be one example of this.
As well, Gertrude Stein. What happened to Gertrude Stein?
Didn't he help out Mr. Pound?
What did he do? Specific, what did he do? What was the relationship? What did this relationship? I don't deny that he did. I don't know what he did.
He was thankful for her teaching him techniques of writing the novel and going from just mere journalism to real novel writing. And Pound, though, I think he betrayed, but he never betrayed Stein in words or in anything he had said.
Well, he simply said thanks for something he received. What did he do?
Well, he was in a position of great financial independence, and when he died, he was he was broke almost. And A.E. Hotchner was an individual that wrote a book about Hemingway, and who met Hemingway as a, you know, it's like a journeyman. An errand boy, more or less, for a newspaper. And his Hotchner cap was really, he got an assignment. He said, go get her, Ernest Hemingway, and write a story on her. And he had dreams of, here's this mythical figure almost sitting up in the clouds writing this fantastic material. And what am I supposed to do, a newspaper man? And he called Ernest Hemingway and was greeted, very, very well. I mean, Hemingway was receptive to everything that this guy was trying to do.
Well,
and through the years,
probably had a bit of an ego, so that he wasn't publicly shy.
Well, yeah, he was, actually.
He
was.
He didn't chase him out the door.
In fact, he avoided large cities like a plague, just for the fact that he didn't want to be among, the fans.
If you were very familiar with this in the Hollywood area, because newspapers avoid publicity at the same time that they seek it.
Well, Hemingway didn't have to seek publicity. I mean, it sought him out. And he, the places...
Name of the game.
He, just as an example, the places he took up residence, Ketchum, Idaho. Who's heard of Ketchum, Idaho? There's a spur railroad that runs into Ketchum, Idaho, I guess. And that's about the extent of it. And then he had a little villa down in Cuba, he had chickens and goats, really secluded. And an individual that would be hunting.
I'm not saying that he wanted a publicity,
Yeah.
But I'm saying that it was pretty big men get fairly decent treatment to people who they approach. Biography.
This book was written after his death.
It was inevitable that someone was going to be, become an authority on him. I mean, the person in that figure, someone's going to get to know him to the point where they can, there certainly could have been ulterior motives in that, but there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, this book was written after his death. He didn't give the guy the material for this book. Right?
Yeah, but he knew very well. He wanted Hotchner to write that autobiography.
Sure. Well, Hotchner didn't even conceive of the idea, as I understand, until after Hemingway had died.
I mean, Hochschild, you know, the wheels were turning. I mean, everybody's out for the buck, and I'm sure Hochschild...